You know how sometimes you hear whispers in your community, things that just don't quite sit right?
Little threads here and there.
Exactly. Well, today we're diving deep into some of those whispers right here in Southeast Houston.
Okay.
We've gathered various bits of information, audio accounts, online discussions, local news snippets.
A mix of sources.
Yeah, and they all seem to be pointing towards some pretty serious allegations surrounding the justice system, particularly in Pasadena and Harris County.
Serious stuff, then.
Very. So our goal in this deep dive is basically to sift through all this information. We want to identify the key threads, the figures involved, and really try to understand what these allegations might mean for you, especially if you're listening in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena.
It's pretty remarkable how these, seemingly separate pieces of information, when you put them together, they start to suggest something potentially bigger, maybe
That's what
interconnected.
it feels like.
Like a troubling situation brewing. You see these personal stories, right? And then they get amplified by like Reddit posts or community discussions, and you put that alongside documented events, and it really hints at issues that, well, maybe go beyond just isolated incidents.
Okay, so let's start with one specific story. It comes from some audio recordings we accessed about an individual we'll call Eric Sanchez.
Okay. Eric Sanchez.
His initial, let's say, wariness of law enforcement,
Yeah.
it didn't just come out of nowhere.
Right. There's usually a reason.
It seems to stem from way back when his brother got a homicide conviction. His brother was only 17 at the time.
Wow, 17.
Yeah. And Eric felt the critical aspects of the case, context about the victim, things like that, were just ignored, overlooked.
Mitigating factors, maybe.
Possibly. But that early experience, it really shaped how he views the whole system.
Yeah, that makes sense. That kind of foundational experience is, well, it's crucial for understanding his perspective, isn't it? It gives you the lens he's using to look at later events, and it kind of fuels his current investigation. It just underscores how these, personal encounters can really color your understanding of broader systemic issues.
So fast forward years later, Eric gets involved with another man, Richard Wayne Collings. We're using two L's here, Collings, just to keep things clear.
Okay, Collings with two L's. Got it.
Eric helped him out first with publishing a book, and then he actually supported his parole back in 2015.
So he was helping him get back on his feet.
Seems like it. And for a while, things looked okay. Collings even worked for Eric for a bit. But then in 2018, something happened that really eroded Eric's trust even further.
Okay, what was that?
Collings was accused of making a terroristic threat. But Eric says it was a false accusation.
A false accusation. How did that play out?
Well, the case just fell apart. Apparently, the accuser's story didn't hold up. It was clearly untrue, and she ended up refusing to testify.
So the accusation itself seems questionable. That 2018 incident, the false accusation against Collings, it really highlights a big concern, right?
Which is.
The potential for the justice system to be, well, misused, and how vulnerable people with prior records are, like Collings on parole,
Right, exactly.
vulnerable to accusations like that, whether they're true or not.
And this is where things take a really concerning turn more recently. Just this past May 2024, Collings was arrested again.
Okay, for what this time?
Alleged sexual assault. But Eric firmly believes this is another wrongful accusation. Completely baseless, he says.
He believes it's wrongful. Does he have reasons?
He claims he does. He says when he tried to present evidence that would exonerate Collings, alibi details, things like that, he was met with hostility, obstruction even, from the Harris County DA's office.
Hostility from the DA's office when offering exculpatory evidence.
That's what he alleges. He even claims he was physically prevented from presenting this invite and basically accused of interfering with their case.
Wow, that's a very serious allegation. If the DA's office is obstructing evidence, that could clear someone.
It's a huge red flag.
Absolutely. It suggests potential bias or maybe just a lack of commitment to, due process. It really makes you question if they're looking at all sides of the story, undermines trust in the whole prosecution process, really.
And it gets even more troubling. Eric claims the authorities are suggesting they have this powerful DNA profile in this current case.
Okay, DNA is usually pretty definitive.
Right. But here's the thing. They haven't actually produced it. Eric says they haven't shown anything.
So they're saying they have it, but not showing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which leads Eric to believe maybe it doesn't actually exist.
Mm.
He thinks they might be trying to pursue what he sees as a questionable parole violation instead, maybe because the main charge isn't solid.
Okay, look, the idea of withheld or even fabricated DNA evidence is extremely serious, like profoundly serious.
It would be.
Forensic evidence carries so much weight. If that's being manipulated, it's a fundamental corruption of the system's reliance on science. And focusing on a parole violation while hinting at DNA they won't show. That definitely needs a closer look.
So this recent arrest, it pushed Eric to dig deeper into Colling's past, specifically his 1978 murder conviction.
Going way back now.
Yeah. Initially, Eric's understanding was maybe it was self-defense or a fight that went bad, something like that.
A more ambiguous situation.
Right. But then, after listening to a podcast discussing the case and actually talking directly with Colling's, a very different story emerged.
Oh, what's Colling's version?
Colling's claims he was coerced. Forced into pleading guilty to a murder that was actually committed by someone else.
Coerced into a guilty plea.
Yeah. He names another individual, John Henry King, as the actual perpetrator.
Whoa. A coerced guilty plea? That raises huge questions, legally speaking. I mean, a plea has to be voluntary, right? Given freely without pressure?
You'd think so.
If Collings' account is accurate, it points to a potential major failure in protecting his rights back then. A failure to ensure a just process.
And the story gets even more complex. Eric alleges actual collusion in that 1978 case.
Collusion? Between who?
Between Colling's own defense attorney at the time, a prosecutor named Kaylee Veltri, and the judge, Robert Johnson.
The defense, the prosecution, and the judge, all working together.
That's the allegation. Eric even mentions the judge's wife was the court reporter. Suggesting, you know, potential conflicts of interest, a system maybe geared towards one outcome.
Wow. Allegations of collusion like that. I mean, that strikes right at the heart of our adversarial legal system.
It really does.
That system relies on checks and balances, right?
Right.
Prosecution, defense, judiciary, keeping each other honest. If those claims are true, it means a total breakdown of the safeguards meant to ensure a fair trial.
Eric also claims that Collings and this other guy, King Gong, were secretly held.
Secretly held? How?
Under King On's name, apparently.
Hmm.
In separate jails for about 2 months. The idea was, supposedly, to cover things up, pressure Collings to plead guilty, and then alter names on court documents afterwards.
Wait, holding people secretly under false identities in jail? That would be a massive violation of due process.
You'd like it.
It raises fundamental questions about transparency, accountability, and manipulating official records on top of that. That just compounds how serious these claims are.
Okay, but here's a potentially huge piece of this. Eric says he's found evidence, including a Houston Police Department call for service record from June 17th, 1978.
An official police record? What does it show?
It apparently suggests Collings was actually the complainant in the incident related to the murder and a victim of a robbery connected to it.
He called the police. As a victim.
That's what this record supposedly indicates.
Mm-hmm.
And it suggests he voluntarily provided the weapon to the police as part of his report.
Wait, the official story was he was arrested on other charges and then confessed and gave up the weapon. Right.
Exactly. This HPD record directly contradicts that narrative.
That is pivotal. If that record shows Collings contacted HPD first as a victim and handed over the weapon, it completely undermines the basis for his murder conviction.
It seems like it would.
And the fact that this information might have been withheld, or at least not known until now, that's deeply concerning regarding transparency, potential obstruction even.
The story doesn't stop there, unfortunately. Collings also had this aggravated robbery conviction in 1981. It resulted in a life sentence.
Another serious conviction.
Yes, but Eric argues this one rested on really weak evidence. Hearsay, mostly.
Hearsay, like secondhand testimony.
Yeah, generally less reliable in court. And apparently a coerced confession from a co-defendant was involved, too. Eventually, that conviction was actually overturned on appeal.
Overturned? Why?
Because the court found they'd improperly used a prior conviction to enhance the sentence to life. A legal error.
Okay, so the fact that an appellate court overturned the 1981 conviction due to legal errors, that itself shows the potential for miscarriages of justice, doesn't it?
It certainly suggests flaws.
Appellate courts are supposed to be that check on trial proceedings. Their intervention here points to significant problems in that initial process.
Then, jump forward to 1994. Collings gets another life sentence. This time for a drug conviction.
Okay.
Eric alleges this was straight up entrapment.
Entrapment? How so?
He claims an undercover informant basically befriended Collings, convinced him to get involved in a plan to rob a pharmacy, and then set him up for arrest in the sting operation.
So the informant initiated the crime plan.
That's the claim. Legally, entrapment is tricky, but it's generally when law enforcement induces someone to commit a crime they wouldn't have otherwise committed.
Right. That allegation raises serious questions about the ethics of police tactics. Sting operations are sometimes necessary, sure, but...
But there's a line.
Exactly. Concerns arise when law enforcement actions might cross that line from investigating crime to actively creating it in someone not predisposed to it.
And finally, just to add another layer, Eric mentions some deeply buried childhood memories that Collings apparently has started recalling.
Childhood memories? Of what?
Collings reportedly remembers witnessing murders as a young child, possibly involving stepfamily members.
Witnessing murders as a kid? That's horrifying.
And he believes one of the stepfamily members actually worked for the Houston Police Department back then and helped cover up crimes.
An HPD officer involved in covering up murders?
That's the claim, based on these memories. He even has a specific recollection, apparently, of a young girl being abducted near Franklin Elementary in the early 1960s.
Wow. These alleged repressed memories. I mean, they're obviously hard to verify definitively after so long.
Extremely difficult.
But they add another incredibly complex layer to Collings' life story and his claims of being exposed to serious criminal activity, potentially even involving people connected to law enforcement from a very young age.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly, but it might connect. We need to talk about another disturbing element from our sources. The suspicious death of Danny Lynn Stevens back in 1976.
Danny Stevens, 1976.
Okay, Richard Wayne Collins. This is the individual whose Reddit posts are part of our source material, not the Collings we just discussed.
Right, different person. Collins 1L.
Yes. He admits online that back in 76, he gave Danny Stevens' name to Pasadena PD.
He gave his name to the police. Why?
Out of spite, apparently. They'd had an argument. He later found out that Danny died while in Pasadena PD custody.
Died in custody?
How? The official ruling was suicide. Hanging? With a straitjacket strap in a padded cell?
Suicide by hanging with a straitjacket strap in a padded cell. That sounds difficult.
It does. And the death of anyone in police custody immediately raises concerns, right?
Yeah.
About the duty of care they have.
Absolutely. Law enforcement has a responsibility for people they detain. And an official finding of suicide in those circumstances, especially with those details, it needs careful scrutiny.
Well, Richard Collins, the one who gave Danny's name, he doesn't buy the suicide ruling at all.
He disputes it.
Strongly. He contends Danny wasn't suicidal. And that the charge he was brought in on auto burglary, a property crime, wouldn't typically lead someone to suicide.
Okay, so what does he think happened?
Collins suspects Danny was actually killed by the police, maybe during an attempt to force a confession, and that the suicide was staged to cover it up.
Killed by police? That's a huge accusation.
It is, and Collins even recounts his own alleged experience of being choked by Pasadena PD officers in a similar location years later, adding a personal angle to his suspicions.
His own experience of alleged mistreatment in the same area, that definitely adds a disturbing dimension to his claims. It suggests, potentially, a pattern of behavior back then.
And what's really troubling are the details coming from some of the Reddit posts and articles discussing the case. They directly challenge the suicide ruling based on, well, physical evidence.
Well, the kind of details.
Things like reports of unusual ligature marks on Danny's neck. Apparently a horizontal mark, not the inverted V shape you usually see in hangings.
Horizontal. That is unusual for hanging.
Right. And there was the discovery of a second belt found in Danny's hand. Why would there be a second belt?
Good question. And anything from the autopsy?
Yes. Internal autopsy findings, things like fluid in the lungs, organ congestion, these are apparently more consistent with asphyxiation, like strangulation, rather than a typical hanging.
Asphyxiation, not hanging. That's a critical distinction.
Absolutely. Plus, just the sheer physical difficulty. How does someone effectively hang themselves with a short strap while confined in a straitjacket? It seems highly improbable.
Yeah, the mechanics seem questionable. So these inconsistencies, the ligature mark, the extra belt, the internal findings, the straitjacket situation, they're significant.
Very.
They all point towards a potential cause of death other than suicide by hanging. It strongly suggests the need for a serious reevaluation of what happened to Danny Stevens.
And tragically, Danny Stevens might not have been an isolated case. Our sources mention other individuals who died under questionable circumstances while in Pasadena PD custody.
No, really? Who else?
There was Willard Russell Considine in 1981, also ruled a suicide by hanging.
Another hanging suicide?
Then Pedro Gonzalez Jr. in 2007, who died from injuries sustained during his arrest. And Mark Oswald in 2015, who died after allegedly being denied medical care for a broken leg in his cell.
Wow. Considine, Gonzalez, Oswald, spanning decades.
Exactly.
The fact that these other custodial deaths happened in the same police department over such a long period, it really does suggest a potential systemic issue, doesn't it? Regarding the safety and well-being of people in their custody.
It raises that possibility.
Each of those cases really deserves its own independent, thorough review to ensure accountability and see if there are patterns of misconduct.
This brings us to the role of one specific person involved in the Danny Stevens case, Dr. Joseph Chikimsek.
Chikimsek. Who was he?
He was Harris County's first chief medical examiner, and he conducted the autopsy on Danny Stevens back in 76.
Okay, the ME who did the autopsy.
Yes, and he had a history. A documented history of controversial rulings, notably misclassifying homicides as suicides in several other high-profile cases.
He misclassified homicides as suicides before.
Yes, the sources mention the cases of Gertrude Zabolio and the Wanstrath family as examples. He actually issued a public apology for those errors later on.
He apologized for getting it wrong in other cases. That's highly relevant to the Stevens case, then.
Extremely relevant.
His involvement, combined with his acknowledged past mistakes in exactly this kind of determination, it casts a pretty significant shadow of doubt over the official suicide ruling for Danny Stevens.
And the fact that Dr. Jakimsek apologized for those past errors, but apparently faced no real professional repercussions?
No accountability.
Seems not, which raises serious questions about the oversight mechanisms back then. And, you know, the potential for similar errors in the Stevens case to have just gone uncorrected.
Yeah, the lack of accountability for documented errors is a problem. It highlights potential weaknesses in the systems meant to ensure forensic findings are accurate and have integrity. It makes you worry about the reliability of other past rulings too, and just emphasizes the need for robust oversight in these critical areas.
So, moving beyond these specific cases, Eric Sanchez and the Collins Calling situation, Danny Stevens, we're seeing these broader allegations of systemic corruption.
Systemic corruption across the board.
The claims point towards both the Pasadena Police Department and the Harris County District Attorney's Office. There are recurring themes like missing or obstructed records.
Obstructed records? Like what?
Well, the police report in that Michael McNadd case we'll touch on detailed records related to Danny Stevens' death.
Things that should be accessible but apparently aren't.
That lack of access is a major barrier to finding the truth.
And there are even claims going way back about a Houston Police Department officer in the 60s and 70s who allegedly would, you know, cover up murders for payment.
A cop covering up murders for money. That's one of the more extreme allegations floating around in these sources.
These broader allegations of systemic issues are, frankly, deeply troubling. They suggest an environment where misconduct could potentially be widespread and maybe hard to uncover, especially if records are missing or blocked.
Right. Transparency is key.
Absolutely. Access to official records is fundamental for transparency and accountability. Without it, how can the public trust the system?
Another name that pops up in these discussions is Johnny Binder.
Johnny Binder. Who's he?
Allegedly a drug dealer back in the day who managed to avoid serious charges.
How?
Through wealth, influence, connections.
Yeah.
Including, reportedly, a link to Judge Robert Johnson.
Judge Robert Johnson again. The same judge from the 1978 Collings case.
The very same one. And Judge Johnson himself is accused in these sources of, well, crooked behavior.
Yeah.
Showing favoritism in court appointments, things like that.
Okay, so Binder allegedly gets off easy due to influence, possibly involving the same judge implicated elsewhere.
That's the connection being made. And add to that, claims that Pasadena PD has obstructed public information requests, making it even harder to verify anything.
Right. The allegations around Binder, if true, really underscore the potential for huge disparities in justice, where wealth and connections might buy you different treatment.
Yeah.
And the reported link to Judge Johnson, who keeps appearing in these different threads, it suggests a potential network of influence that could seriously undermine the whole idea of equal justice. And obstructing public records requests, that just makes people more suspicious that there's something to hide.
Okay, let's briefly touch on that other case mentioned. Michael McNatt.
Michael McNatt, right.
Yeah.
What was his situation?
He was allegedly wrongfully convicted. The charges were solicitation of capital murder and aggravated kidnapping.
Serious charges. Wrongfully convicted, though.
That's the claim. There were reported irregularities, like rewritten indictments, questions about the credibility of a key witness described as compromised, and just dubious evidence, like a letter in an index card.
Rewritten indictments, a compromised witness, that sounds problematic.
McNatt himself claimed he was a victim of entrapment and manipulation by law enforcement. Interestingly, he was actually acquitted on one of the charges, the solicitation of murder, I believe.
Acquitted on one.
But convicted on the other, the kidnapping charge, even though the two cases were apparently closely linked.
Huh. Acquitted on one related charge, but convicted on the other. That seems odd. The McNatt case, as described, it just presents another instance where the legal process looks potentially flawed.
Yeah.
It raises serious questions about the fairness of the investigation, the prosecution, the issues with the indictment, the witness, the evidence. They highlight these potential vulnerabilities in the system that unfortunately can lead to wrongful convictions.
So let's bring this all back home. For those of you listening, especially in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, what does all this potentially mean for our community?
Right. What's the local impact?
What we've laid out today are some very serious allegations. Misconduct, potential wrongful convictions, these disturbing patterns, maybe, within our local justice system right here.
These aren't just abstract legal theories.
Not at all. They directly impact the safety, the fairness, the accountability of the very institutions that are supposed to serve and protect us right here where we live.
Mm-hmm.
If there's even some truth to these allegations, it could signal a significant erosion of trust, a lack of real justice in our own neighborhoods. And it just underscores how important it is to be informed, you know, engaged in what's happening locally. And frankly, demanding transparency from our public officials.
Precisely. When you connect these individual stories, these different allegations, a larger and, yeah, more concerning picture starts to emerge about the integrity of the local justice system. And for residents right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, this isn't just about history. It has real implications for the present, for the future well-being of our community.
Absolutely.
It highlights that critical need for active civic engagement, for demanding accountability from our institutions, police, prosecutors, courts, and ensuring that the legal system operates with fairness and justice for everyone. The fact that these allegations keep surfacing across different times involving different people, it really raises significant concerns about potential systemic issues that need attention, maybe even reform.
So as you go about your day, maybe driving through Deer Park or grabbing coffee in LaPorte or running errands in Pasadena, here's something to think about.
Yeah.
What does it really signify for our community when such serious questions, such deep concerns are raised about the very system designed to ensure justice and safety for all of us? And maybe more importantly, what active role can each of us play right here, locally, to promote transparency, demand accountability, and, you know, strive for a fairer, more just community for everyone.